I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Ed Klonoski. He's the president of Charter Oak State College, and he's been in that position for about a year and a half, and we're going to talk about distance learning and the way that information technology is changing higher ed, and in particular, this area of learning through the net. So welcome, Ed.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, you have been involved in this topic of information technology-based education for a while.
Yeah, probably 20 years all told. I taught at the University of Hartford, taught writing, and we began to integrate computers into writing instruction. I didn't know anything about computers, but they had this free lab and they offered me an opportunity to learn something. And then we networked the computers into a LAN and we put the LAN on the internet, and along the way I realized that internet technology, which was essentially improvements in the way we can communicate, would affect every industry, including higher ed. And in fact, it has.
Tell us about Charter Oak. Charter Oak is a relatively new institution.
Well, it's 36 years old.
36 years old.
It was invented with two other institutions like it in the early 70s. It's called an external degree granting institution. And the idea was women were interrupting their college education to get married and have children. When they returned to get their degree, they were being told by the institutions, well, start over. And these institutions were created to validate prior learning and treat adults as if they had actually learned things along the way. So for years and years, what Charter Oak did was it accepted credits from any regionally accredited institution. It did things like portfolio for credit. So if you'd been a writer in corporate America, you could get credits for the fact that you knew how to write. It did CLEPS and Dante's testing for credit. For the last decade, what we've been exploring is distance learning courses for credit.
So it was kind of an integrator of educational experiences.
Yes,
before.
It aggregated credits. It aggregated experiences from other places. It didn't have a residency requirement. So back then, students got their degree from Charter Oak, but perhaps never took any credits from Charter Oak State College.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is different. About 71% of our graduates now have actually taken courses with us.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's increasingly important because we have an increasingly fragmented educational experience with students getting bits and pieces from different colleges.
Yeah, two things are going on. One, there's always been a group of people whose education got interrupted. I picture somebody in the military. So they're stationed for 2 years in one place. They accumulate credits at the local community college. They get moved someplace else. They accumulate more credits. So gypsies have always had an issue putting together the whole degree. Now you've got student swirl happening. So somebody goes to the community college for a year or two, picks up some credits, takes a break, comes to UConn, gets some credits, has a job change, leaves the state, goes somewhere else. So we're set up in a very good place to do what's called degree completion. We'll help you finish all of that. There's another phenomenon going on. Our competitor nations, South Korea, Japan, are educating more people than we are. And if we want to keep up with the number of college degrees that they're producing, we're going to have to do about 1 million degrees a year from the over 22 population, because we're not making any more 18 to 22-year-olds. That pipeline's fixed. So Charter Oak, which is an adult-focused institution, that's all we do is educate grown-ups, is going to become increasingly important. And I think distance learning, which allows people to continue to work and continue to support their family while they integrate an education into their life, is going to be the way we get that done.
Mm-hmm. As people are getting older, and also as the economy and our technological infrastructure changes more rapidly, it seems like there's a growing importance for this kind of continuing education, the ability for people who have families and who have obligations to be able to get increasing technical education as they go along.
Yeah, that's one piece of it. People need degrees. Something like 2 out of 3 new jobs requires a college degree. The idea that people need to keep learning has changed, too. I mean, my father worked at Allstate. He was a claims adjuster. He did personal injury stuff. He did that same thing for 35 years. That was his whole career. I think he went away for training once towards the end of his work life. That's not how jobs operate anymore. People keep getting asked to do new things. The kids that are in college today are going to get jobs that don't exist yet, by and large. So continuing education also means you have to keep learning new things. And once again, the way that we're going to do that is to project the learning to the learner. We can't keep expecting that everybody's going to be able to go to the learning.
Well, I still am vague because I've never participated in a distance learning course. I've never taught one. I've never taken one. I attempted to teach one. It didn't work very well. Through a little nonprofit that we had, I attempted to set up a 10-week course and none of us participated as we should have, and it didn't work very well. Okay, so I want to know, what does it mean when you sign on and you do a distance learning course at Charter Oak? How does it work?
Well, first, each of our courses has a template so that as faculty produce course content, and I'll tell you what all that content consists of in a moment, it's all entered into a template that for the student makes each course have the same visual and organizational structure. So it's not like a website where every time you go to a new website, you have to kind of figure out where everything is. Here, every course is going to look and feel pretty much the same.
Syllabus here, greetings here.
The rules about plagiarism are all in the same place. The biography on the faculty person is there. You're going to see a picture. You're going to know where your students are. The course start dates, all of that, all in one place from course to course. The courses consist of several distinct pieces. There's going to be probably a textbook assigned with the course, as there would be with any other. There's going to be a series of assignments with due dates. There's going to be class discussions, but those take place in something called a threaded discussion. They take place across time. Every course is going to have a cohort of students. Every course is going to be sequenced through either 5 weeks, 8 weeks, 14 weeks, some discrete set of time. So basically, courses are broken down into a week of activities. So during that week, you'll have to participate in the threaded discussion. You'll have to do some readings. You may have to do some research, some writing. You may take a test. But you'll be able to handle the week's assignments on your schedule. So you can do it at night, on Saturdays, whenever you have the time to do the work. Does that begin to get at?
Yeah. So the threaded discussion is, it's like a forum, you know, what we
yes.
call another.
You could call it a forum. That's another threat. So it's instead of what typically happens in a college classroom, which is at best a dialogue. Usually it's a monologue. So the professor comes in, she or he says some things, somebody asks some questions, the professor answers that one set of questions. And at the best, you're going to have two people talking. Here, the students can talk to each other. They can talk to the professor. They can ignore the professor. It's really a multi-log. And it's recorded. So at the end of each month or each segment, the teacher can actually look to see how much a student participated, the depth of those comments, the value of whatever it is that they produced.
How's the value determined?
Well, what we do when we train our faculty is we say you want the students to behave like junior members of your discipline. So instead of you going out and doing a bunch of reading and synthesizing that information and organizing it into a presentation and delivering it to the class, activities that make the professor smart, have your students do those things, teach them how. So in the thread of discussions, a student will have done a piece of original research, will have presented that research to her fellow students, and the students will comment on and get involved in a discussion of what it was that the student presented. So each student gets the opportunity to behave like a faculty person. It's beautiful.
So how much pedagogical re-education does that take? I mean, I had very little pedagogical education before I started teaching.
It does take some, because when I taught, the primary modality was oral. I spoke, students listened.
Right.
The presumption was everybody's a good oral learner, everybody's a good listener. Well, in fact, there's only one subpopulation that tend to be really good oral learners, and it's faculty. Almost everybody else doesn't learn very well that day. Look at him. my stepson's here sitting, listening to us, not having a real great time listening to us talk. He'll learn a whole lot more if he gets a chance to talk. So what we had to teach faculty was we're not going to have any lectures. And that's changed now with things like iTunes University and multimedia. But 10 years ago when we began this, there was no way to do a lecture. So we had to say to faculty, you have to create an activities-based learning scenario. You have to give your students things to do that in the process of doing them and thinking about what they did, they'll actually learn. So if you want to teach the education, for example, one of our faculty had every student go to their local Board of Education, take notes on a Board of Education meeting. They all came back and reached the same conclusion. That's not a very good way to run a highway. So they had an original learning experience, and then they shared what they learned with each other. So it's activities-based learning rather than just listening to someone tell you things.
Mm-hmm. And also learning these tools that are in the courseware that you're using, right? So learning to analyze student participation and how many times they access the sites and those kinds of things.
The software actually does that for you. I mean, you can click a button and you can say, find John Smith's responses, and it'll pull just those out and list everything John Smith has written for the last 30 days. I mean, it does make that kind of measurement easier.
Mm-hmm.
But faculty always knew how to evaluate a class discussion. The problem was they did it on the fly. So, you know, you're going to have a digital recording of this talk, but typically, if you and I had this conversation, you would have a memory of what I said, and you'd say, well, he was fairly bright today. That was pretty good class participation. He had a good day, but you'd have no record. Now they actually have a record.
There's the classic observation on the internet, no one knows that you're a dog. Do you think that distance learning changes some of the biases that are implicit in face-to-face relationships with students?
Well, the best way to get at that is to tell you a story. When I taught at the University of Hartford, we had a population of Malaysian students. Interesting folks. But if you had female Malaysian students and male Malaysian students in the same classroom, the women would never speak, ever. They would never outshine one of their male colleagues. If you could get just Malaysian women in a classroom, they were fine, they were bright, they were participatory. But in their culture, women did not outshine men. It probably wouldn't be a surprise to know I sat in the front row and dominated most of the class discussions I was in because I'm mouthy. Online, shy people, quiet people, blind people, deaf people, all can participate in the class discussion without necessarily giving away any of those qualities about themselves.
I know a number of Asperger's mm-hmm. kind of folks who are incredible communicators, yep. voluminous communicators online, mm-hmm. but you look, try to communicate to them face-to-face and they can't do anything but look at their shoes.
Well, because it takes the social piece out. Mason's brother is on the spectrum. And we have lots of contact with folks who have Asperger's. And it is lots of people for whom conversation, academic conversation, takes preparation. So, I mean, you and I turn on the mics and we're talking. I don't know how much prep you did. I did a few minutes. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily how everybody does their work. So if all we do is validate people who are quick, we leave behind people who need to be a little time to be thoughtful. These online discussions do not reward you for being glib. Mm-hmm. They reward you for being thoughtful. So everybody's included at whatever pace they choose to include themselves. It's really great.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of course material don't work as well? So for instance, you know, scientific course learning that would require a lab. How right. Can you do don't, that online?
Not really. I mean, one of the reasons people come, we're sitting on UConn's campus. I mean, one of the things that UConn has to offer that's powerful is state-of-the-art laboratories with equipment that's very expensive and actually very rare, but it is the exact equipment that people use out in industry. So if you want to take chemistry and you want to work with really powerful microscopes, you're not going to do that in your kitchen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do what we call a kitchen experiment. You can take a basic bio course and you can do labs in your kitchen sink. So we can do some things, but we can't do stuff that's going to require specialized equipment.
Social sciences, humanities.
Anything seminar-based works great. Yeah. Master-apprentice stuff doesn't work very well either. Mm-hmm. So if your job was to follow around a master and imitate her behavior and then get some feedback from her on how well you were doing, that doesn't work particularly well online. Mm-hmm. But if the course is basically a seminar course, for example, almost everything at the master's level is seminar-based, those things translate to web, and in fact, they're better online than they would be in person mm-hmm. because everybody is included all the time.
So for some fields, you wouldn't be able to do everything online, but you could do a lot online.
And I'll give you an example of that. We had a challenge in Connecticut. We're short nurses. So we thought, gee, there's people out there that have a nursing certificate, but it's lapsed. They haven't nursed for a while. How do we get them recertified? Well, it turns out they need two academic pieces, and they need to go back into a hospital and review some clinical. So we put a nurse refresher course online, which was the two academic pieces. We asked area hospitals, would you do this for some nurse who wanted to get recertified? They was lined up around the block because to them it was just employee training. And if somebody was halfway decent and we did the academic piece, they were not only going to do the clinical, they were going to hire this person. So there we broke it apart, and that worked great.
Do you have CME for doctors as well?
We have a pharmacy refresher. We don't have anything for doctors per se, but we're trying to do a continuing education for all those things that tend to happen at golf courses and hotels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the professionals like to travel, but they sort of want to go where they want. And they don't want to go to your hotel because they need their continuing ed units. So more and more of those, the real estate pieces, all the professionals that need to be continually trained, more and more of that is going online.
Now, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and it's extremely painful for my wife and I because we both went to an expensive liberal arts college. And I work at an expensive liberal arts college. My wife's here at UConn, so not quite as expensive, although probably the expenses are equivalent, but the cost to the parent, it wouldn't be the equivalent. But at any rate, my kid is thinking about going to college, and it's painful for us because we are facing this incredible cost challenge of we would like to be able to say you could go anywhere, but we can't really, in all conscience, say that.
Yeah.
Distance learning in the current, especially in the times we live in, which is, you know, where the finances are collapsing and where there's no control yet on the inflation of costs in higher ed, distance learning poses this question, is could we redesign this whole higher educational endeavor in a way that cuts out a lot of the things that are really, really expensive?
Students are already doing that. They're behaving like consumers. When we started this distance learning thing 10 years ago, I was running the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium, so I was helping everybody do this. We found out that 25% of the students in any given semester were taking courses at more than one institution. So they were trying to put their academic package together the way you would put a purchase together. And they're going to buy the monitor here and the CPU there. That's not how higher ed wants you to consume its product, but that's how they were. The problem for your daughter is that she wants to have a residential collegiate experience. I mean, her mother works at a residential institution, which is what UConn is. And residential college experiences are fairly expensive. I mean, the CSU system in our state system would be your best bargain for a residential experience. UConn is really competitively priced against Research One universities like Yale. So although UConn is more expensive than CSU would be, it's dramatically less expensive than Boston University, which is where my daughter just graduated. We do know that there's three kinds of institutions that are going to succeed in this economic landscape. One is Research Ones that continue to be well-funded by their state. So if UConn can continue to keep its funding up with the state of Connecticut, at the end of this crisis, UConn will be stronger than ever, and it's pretty strong now. The other two kinds of institutions that are going to succeed are those that are affordable and those that are online. And Charter Oak is both affordable and online. Now, Charter Oak will have very little appeal to your 16-year-old daughter. But once she finishes her bachelor's degree, or if she wants to get ahead in her bachelor's degree and finish early, she will take courses online from institutions like Charter Oak in order to accelerate her progress. Our summer enrollment's up 25% from last summer. Many of these are visiting students who are either catching up or getting ahead so that they graduate on time. That's the key variable.
Do you have high school students taking AP through Charter Oak?
Yes, we do, because we have a virtual high school that we're running for the state of Connecticut, actually two of them.
You actually were working in that before you got into Charter Oak?
That's a Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium project. They had a virtual high school they've been running now for 7 years in the adult diploma world. That's the high school dropout world. And 2.5 or 3 years ago, they started a virtual high school for all of the citizens of Connecticut. So they're doing advanced placement. They're doing credit recovery. I mean, they're teaching Chinese online. Great opportunity, because there's no school district that's big enough, rich enough, to be able to create every course every student might want at that district. But as a state, we should be able to provide any course any student wants or needs to graduate on time.
I'm glad you mentioned the Chinese, because this has been one of my ambitions, is to get back into I took 1 year of Chinese as an undergraduate, and I've been wanting to do Chinese. But if I take it at Trinity, I have to, be in the class mm-hmm. three times a week and go to the labs, and it just would blow my mind, I think, to add that onto my other obligations. But I imagine a distance learning Chinese course would be far more flexible, and I'd be able to fit it in.
It would be flexible, and now because the technology's gotten richer, you can now do audio pieces. I mean, there's a piece of software called Wimba that lets you do, we talked about a threaded discussion. Mm-hmm. You can do one that's oral. So the messages you leave behind aren't written, they're spoken. So it's a way for you to practice your Chinese or your French. You listen, you speak. The teacher has a record of what you said, how your pronunciation went. And it's no more complicated than a written form would be. You need a $15 microphone and you're good to go.
Let's talk about the evolution of technology, because although you're relatively inexpensive, there must be an enormous challenge keeping up with the latest technological developments. So,
well, one of the interesting things that happened on that front, and I used to be in charge of labs at the University of Hartford 15 years ago, is that individual human beings now own the technology they need to access these learning resources. So 10 years ago, we had to spend a lot of time making sure people's CPUs were up to speed, they had the latest operating system, the things worked with other things. Increasingly, computers are commodities. Everybody has them. I mean, before we started this, I shut off my iPhone. You literally could take one of our courses with nothing more than a smartphone. Mm-hmm. The cut-paste function would be tricky, because it's the new model of the iPhone that's going to have that. Everybody has the technology that they need now. So we don't have to supply it. People have already bought and own it. And they use it for critical things like banking, purchasing, IMing, talking to each other, email. So since the technology has really integrated itself into ordinary people's lives, particularly these next couple of generations, we're just trying to take advantage of what folks already have.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I've done in the last couple of years before I got bored with it was, getting into Second Life, and I got invited to give various talks in Second Life. And it was a hoot, you know, to get in there, have your avatar stand in front of a group of, you know, furry things and flying things. And the technology that we were using, there was a PowerPoint presentation behind me that I had uploaded ahead of time. And sometimes I was uploading an MP3 of my talk, and so we would just play the talk and the PowerPoint, and then I would answer questions, and sometimes text, sometimes voice. And it was a kind of a prelude. It was not yet anything that would be cool enough or engaging enough or useful enough to want to do a full course in it. But it was kind of a prelude to the full virtualization of distance learning. And there are people there in these talks from all over the world participating. So I don't know if you've begun to think about what more virtual, more voice, more text, more video might mean in terms of this full virtual experience.
Well, there's a couple of things that I think are, one thing's happening now, and one thing I think is going to happen and be enormous. The thing that's happening now is the integration of the rest of the media with the written word and online instruction. One of the things that the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium just did was buy an iTunes University contract for the whole state. So the idea here is that everybody can use this resource to put up lectures, to put up interesting media pieces, and share those for free with each other. So what you were trying to do in Second Life is becoming more powerful in ordinary places. But I think the thing that Second Life is fooling with that's going to be huge is simulations. We've been teaching pilots to fly this way for years, for generations. SimCity just came out with its newest piece. There are so many excellent simulations out there playing around being games. Simulations are a powerful way for human beings to learn things. It imitates natural learning. It's how we all learned about gravity.
Did you hear about this high school in New York City that's trying to redesign its entire curriculum around the game metaphor? It uses actual simulation games, but it also has every curricular piece is designed as a series of achievables that lead you onto another stage of the educational experience.
I want to go there.
No, yeah,
I
it sounds
heard
fun.
That story, but I mean, they're early. We don't have a simulation for everything we need to simulate, and they are really difficult to build. They're not expensive. They're not cheap. They require programming. But they are really powerful ways for people to do a couple of things. First of all, you want to be able to offer people a chance to learn through trial and error. As an organism, that's how we're built to learn things. So if I tell you the right answers, that's not as powerful as you discovering them. So you get when you build these simulations, people do things, they work out, they don't work out. They try again, it works out better, works out worse. And in the process of trying, they master a whole set of things that teach them multiple ways to get to the finish line. Now, and you can connect those simulations up to other people, so they play them in groups, and we're very social creatures. So this war game that everybody's playing online that I don't play is that. It's a simulation. It's a multi-user game. It's powerful as all get out. People actually get addicted to it. Mm-hmm. Imagine people addicted to biology and algebra. This would be a good thing.
Well, I was an early adopter because I bought a lot of educational software for my kids when they were growing up. And the Jumpstart series, Jumpstart first grade, second grade, and they went through all that. I don't know how educationally useful it was, but I look forward to the time when you could do that kind of full virtualization. And one of the things I think it suggests about the future of education is the individualization of education. The idea of not having a bunch of kids in the same classroom learning the same thing just because they're all the same age, right, which doesn't make any sense at all.
And that was the factory metaphor, and it was an efficiency thing. If we can bring everybody together and we can march them through an identical curriculum with identical resources, we're no longer punishing poor people. Everybody's getting access to the same stuff. That's powerful. Mass customization, where everybody gets access to what they need when they need it, was impossible at that point in time. Now, even in industry, that's the idea. You know, we want to give the process what it requires, when it requires, the minute it requires it. That's where we're heading. And it's difficult for us to even imagine it because we're still on an agrarian school calendar. It's very hard for us to let go of the things that formed us as adults. So doctors are still making doctors in training do 36-hour work periods, even though everybody knows and all the research indicates they're dumb as dirt for the last 8 hours of that. They're doing it because their mentors did it. You know, we're doing this school day that starts at 8 and ends at 2:30 because that's what we all did. Even though we know, for example, high school students do not learn well early in the morning, they're still unconscious. So slowly but surely, the technology is letting us shift the learning moment out of the classroom moment into the rest of people's lives. Once we've embraced that shift, Then we can begin to customize the learning piece itself. And we can let these youngsters fly rather than all walk at the same pace.
One of the things that the virtualization of cultural experience, so music and film and books, poses, one of the challenges it poses is the increasing ability for people to share that material. Mm-hmm. And for it to escape the bounds of patents and copyrights and property ownership. So there's been a lot of discussion in higher ed about open sourcing higher ed. MIT's made a commitment to put all of its lectures online, all of its curriculums, and they've done it, which I know that people in Bangladesh are trying to take an MIT curriculum through that avenue. So what kind of discussions have there been at the state level about that kind of open sourcing?
Well, the thing the state did that I'm very proud of is create something called ICON. So it's a set of library resources available to everybody, the K-12, higher ed, other libraries. So everybody can have access to the same research materials from wherever they are, basically at no cost. When the governor was lieutenant governor, she was one of the sponsors of ICON. It's a tremendous thing. So information is increasingly available to everybody from anywhere. What MIT did was really kind of interesting. They put course information online, but they didn't put the course online. What a course is a structured learning experience. What you pay a faculty or a mentor or instructor to do for you is create and then monitor you as you go through some kind of structured learning experience. It has a set of inputs and a set of outcomes and set of measures along the way. There's coaching and prompting and encouragement as you go through it. MIT didn't put all of that online. They just put PowerPoints, articles, and information online. Well, one of the things we know about the internet revolution is that it shifted information from a thing that was scarce to a thing that's plentiful. In fact, maybe overly plentiful. So I don't think information in and of itself is particularly interesting anymore. What we've really focused on now is what do you do with information to produce knowledge or something else of value? And that question is as easy to answer in an online course as it is an in-person course.
Hmm. Okay, Ed, if people are interested in exploring Charter Oak's potentials for them, where do they go?
www.charteroak.edu. Where else would they go?
Is it okay if we talk a little bit about the financing, what it would take to per course?
Yeah, I think our per credit rate right now is $186 a credit. So at the junior and senior level, we have the lowest cost baccalaureate credits anywhere in the state. We offer an associate's and a bachelor's degree. We just got approved in the legislature to begin to build a master's degree. We'll have that done, I hope, in a couple of years. So you can take courses from us. You can still enroll in our 5-week summer session until the end of this month. I believe it starts on June 29th.
Is there different pricing for people in Connecticut and outside of Connecticut?
Yes, there is a differential. If you're from outside Connecticut, you pay more. I don't remember the exact amount.
Okay.
But what we actually do is subsidize Connecticut residents. That's the idea, because we're supported by the legislature.
But I understand you have a significant number of students from around the country and around the world, military service people.
We're about a 60-40% split. So about 40% of our students are from out of state. About 30% of our online students are from out of state. For some reason, online is still more of a local geographic phenomenon. And this is true across the country with everyone except the Phoenixes, the national advertising institutions. And we can't afford a national advertising budget yet.
University of Phoenix, that last reference. I'll have to talk about them some other time. But okay, great. I've been speaking with Ed Klonoski. He's the president of Charter Oak State College, an online distance learning-focused educational institution here in Connecticut. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.